This evening,
you can hear the sound of a stream behind me here. We're trying something new this evening, you know, calm everybody down, you know, pretend it's a mountain stream. If I can sell you that story, I can sell you something else. No, we're having some problems with the baptistry and trying to fill it, so hopefully you can ignore the noise in the course of our study this evening. I apologize. I walked out this evening from the house and forgot to get the handout to run off tonight. So tonight you're just going to have to wing it. You're just going to have to, you know, pay attention and look on the screen. It should be fairly simple, though. There's not a lot of material to cover here, but it should be enough to keep us busy for the next 35 minutes. We have, in recent weeks, been looking at some of the other kings. Let's see, there we go. Saul, David, Solomon, and Rehoboam. And as we pointed out last week, these are the first four kings of Israel. And the big event in the reign of Rehoboam was the rebellion of the 10 northern tribes. And from that point forward, the rest of the history of Israel is concerned with two kingdoms, the histories of two kingdoms running in parallel with each other. Both can claim, of course, a direct connection to Abraham, and in some respect have some connection to the promises to Abraham and so forth. But it's that conflict between these two kingdoms then that defines the rest of the history of the Old Testament. And what we're looking at tonight, then, is the story of Jeroboam. And Jeroboam is the young man that was chosen by the 10 northern tribes to be their king in the breakaway kingdom. And so, at least for the first few years of this parallel existence, Rehoboam was king of the southern kingdom, Jeroboam king of the northern kingdom. And Jeroboam is the one we're going to be looking at tonight. And again, our purpose is not to try to extract all the historical trivia about these men. We're more concerned about their character. Were they good men, bad men, a mix of the two? And what made them that way? And what were the manifestations of their character and the way that they behaved, not just as administrators of their kingdoms, but as individuals? And their relationships with other people. That's the sort of thing that we're trying to focus on. Particularly, of course, their relationship to God. So before we get going, Andy Harrison, could I get you to lead us in prayer, please?
Most holy and awesome God, in heaven, we are so thankful that we have the opportunity to come here together, to grow in the Christian life, to open up the Bible, to study together.
All right. As we customarily do, we'll spend the first few minutes just looking at the story of Jeroboam. And the relevant passages are roughly in chapters 11, the last half of chapter 11, and then chapters 12, 13, and 14. The story begins with Jeroboam actually as a servant in the kingdom of Solomon. fact, I believe the exact title that he had, that he was the head of the labor force in Solomon's kingdom, in the northern part of the kingdom. And apparently he was quite capable in this, did a good job of it, and Solomon had promoted him personally to that position. But then in the closing verses of chapter 11, that isn't what I wanted. Let's turn to chapter 11 and just briefly glance at some of the details here. In verse 29 of chapter 11, it happened at that time when Jeroboam went out of Jerusalem that the prophet Ahijah the Shilonite met him on the way. And let me just pause right there and ask you to file that name away right now. Ahijah the Shilonite, prophet of God. Okay, Ahijah met him on the way, and he clothed himself with a new garment, and the two were alone in the field. Then Ahijah took hold of the new garment that was on him and tore it into 12 pieces. And he said to Jeroboam, "Take for yourself 10 pieces, for thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, behold, I will tear the kingdom out of the hand of Solomon and will give 10 tribes to you. But he shall have one tribe for the sake of my servant David and for the sake of Jerusalem, the city by which I have chosen out of all the tribes of Israel." By the way, what is 10 plus 1? 11. How many tribes of Israel are there? Okay. Anybody got a problem with this? I'm sorry? Okay, I think that's the answer. Yeah, Rehoboam, just by default, can count on his own tribe, the tribe of Judah. I think the explanation is he's going to get one tribe in addition to his own tribe. So that'd be Judah and, of course, Benjamin, as it turned out. And then the other 10 would go to Jeroboam. Okay, we move on. Because they have forsaken me and worshipped Asheroth, the goddess of the Sidonians, Chemosh, the god of the Moabites, Milcom, the god of Ammon, and have not walked in my ways to do what was right in my eyes, keep my statutes and my judgments as did his father David. However, I will not take the whole kingdom out of his hand, because I have made him ruler all the days of his life for the sake of my servant David, whom I chose because he kept my commandments and my statutes. But I will take the kingdom out of his son's hand and give it to you, 10 tribes. Let's skip down. I'll make you king over all of Israel. Then look at verse 38. Then it shall be, if you heed all that I command you, walk in my ways and do what is right in my sight, to keep my statutes and my commandments, as my servant David did, then I will be with you and build for you an enduring house, as I built for David, and will give Israel to you. And I will afflict the descendants of David because of this, but not forever. So, did Jeroboam just decide on his own accord that he's going to rebel against Solomon and go off and do this thing? This was clearly from God, right? Actually, he was, but they probably were not aware of this little exchange here. So you kind of have two tracks going here. God has his own plan in motion, and of course the 10 tribes have their own intent, what they're trying to accomplish. In fact, we saw this last week, and Judd, of course, is right, that the breakup of the kingdom was from God. In fact, what did we read right here as to the reason why this breakup was going to happen? Because, yeah, they turned away from him. And particularly Solomon. Start at the top, right? Solomon started dabbling in idolatry, and it just trickled down to the rest of the nation. And this was God's punishment on Solomon and the people, that they were no longer going to be a united, prosperous people. And I want you to just notice right now, we're going to talk about this further. Who did God compare Jeroboam to in terms of the promise that he's giving him? David, right. God had given a promise to David to give him the kingdom, and now God is telling Jeroboam, I'm going to give you a kingdom just like I gave David. Now just Keep that in mind as we go forward. And so in chapter 12, the 10 tribes chose him to be their king after this tax revolt. And actually, we spent some time in chapter 12 last week talking about Rehoboam's actions in all of this. In verse 20 of chapter 12, it came to pass when all Israel heard that Jeroboam had come back, they sent for him and called him to the congregation and made him king over all Israel. And there was none who followed the house of David but the tribe of Judah only. Now, there too, Benjamin has to be included in this number. I'm not sure why it says the tribe of Judah only. One more thing I wanted to notice before we left chapter 11. Look back in verse 26 of chapter 11, where Jeroboam is introduced. It says that he's an Ephraimite from Zeretha, whose mother's name was Zeruah, a widow, also rebelled against the king. Another little tidbit I want you to file away. And just what we're doing here is just kind of constructing the story, see how all this came to pass. Okay, so they have asked him to be their king, and to this point we can see the hand of God behind all of this. But now look at what happens in the closing verses of chapter 12. Beginning in verse 25, and Jeroboam built Shechem in the mountains of Ephraim and dwelt there. Also he went out from there and built Penuel. And Jeroboam said in his heart, now the kingdom may return to the house of David. If these people go up to offer sacrifices in the house of the Lord at Jerusalem, then the heart of this people will turn back to their Lord, Rehoboam king of Judah, and they will kill me and go back to Rehoboam king of Judah. So the king asked advice, made 2 calves of gold, said to the people, it is too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Here are your gods, O Israel, which brought you up from the land of Egypt. He set up one in Bethel, and the other he put in Dan. And this thing became a sin, for the people went to worship before the one as far as Dan. He made shrines on the high places, made priests from every class of people who were not of the sons of Levi. He goes on making feast days to compete with the feast days in Jerusalem. What's he doing here? He's protecting his own interest, right? Yeah, this... I'm sorry? No, it didn't. Yeah, he had no inhibitions at all about doing this. But really, as I say here, he's consolidating his power. He clearly fears that the people are going to, over time, their allegiance is going to shift back to Rehoboam. Now, why would he imagine that could happen? Recall what the law said was an obligation for every Israelite male. 3 times a year, what do they have to do? I'm sorry? Well, it was more than offer sacrifice. Where did they have to offer? Yeah, they had to go to Jerusalem for the 3 main feast days. And there at Jerusalem, they would offer the sacrifices. You know, they would get in touch with their God at the place where he had chosen his name to dwell among them. That was the temple. Temple's in Jerusalem. That's in the southern kingdom. That's Rehoboam's territory. So if he's got the bulk of his population 3 times a year making this pilgrimage down to Jerusalem and back again, what's that going to do to their allegiance to him as king of this breakaway nation? That's his fear, that their allegiance is going to weaken, and eventually, if they find any kind of frustration with Jeroboam's leadership, they will transfer back to their allegiance back to Rehoboam, and he's out of a job. In fact, when a king is out of a job back in those days, what does that usually mean? Yeah, it's going to be bad news. So what he's doing here is he's trying to... We would call this today job security. He's trying to set himself up for a permanent position and minimize the risk of losing his subjects' attention and loyalty. And the way he does that is by creating this alternate religion. They're now going to, instead of going to Jerusalem, they will go to Dan or Bethel, where these golden calves have been set up. He has his own priesthood, has his own feast days. I mean, in every respect, it's kind of an alternative reality to the religion that they've been accustomed to, that is centered in Jerusalem. And in his mind, this is perfectly valid because it keeps him in power. It's good for him. Now, of course, ultimately, what's the long-term impact of this? Well, it's not good for him. It's not good for his nation, is it? I mean, basically, he's cutting them off from God. They claim to worship the same God, but the manner in which they're doing it is completely out of bounds from what God has told them they ought to do. Okay, God, of course, is not unaware of what Jeroboam is doing, and so not once but twice he sends prophets to Jeroboam warning him, what you're doing here is not right. Look in chapter 13. I wish we had time to really go into chapter 13 in detail. We do not. We're just going to have to pass over this. It's a lesson all into itself. This is the story of the anonymous young prophet who goes from Judah up to where Jeroboam is at with a message of condemnation, rebuking him. You should not do this. And Jeroboam's reaction was lash out at this young prophet. Said, arrest him, put him in chains. And when Jeroboam reached out his hand toward this young prophet, what happened to his hand? Yeah, it just withered. And of course, Jeroboam is no dummy. He can take a hint. You know, this is from God. And so he begs, you know, relief here and gets it. But, you know, the message has been delivered. Jeroboam is doing wrong in setting up this alternate religion. And, of course, the rest of the chapter is about this young prophet and what happens to him. But we're going to have to pass that by. Chapter 14, years later, look at in verse 1 of chapter 14. At that time, Abijah, the son of Jeroboam, became sick, and Jeroboam said to his wife, please arise and disguise yourself, that they may not recognize you as the wife of Jeroboam, and go to Shiloh. Indeed, Ahijah the prophet is there, who told me that I would be king over this people. Now, I asked you earlier to remember the name of the man who originally came to Jeroboam and said, you're going to be king. Who was it? Ahijah, right? Only this time it says that, let's see, where is it? Yeah, look at the last line of verse 4. Ahijah could not see, for his eyes were glazed by reason of his age. So apparently there are some years that have transpired here. Now Ahijah is a really old man, and he can't even see anymore. But Jeroboam sends his wife on this mission to Ahijah to inquire of the Lord about their son. He's very sick. We won't read all the rest of this, but basically, when Jeroboam's wife walks in the door through divine intervention, Ahijah, even though he's blind, he recognizes her. And even though she's trying to disguise herself, he instantly identifies her, says, oh yeah, and I know why you're here, and here's the outcome of this. And if you haven't read the story, what does he tell Jeroboam's wife is going to happen to their son? He is going to die. When you go back home and your foot crosses the threshold into your home, he will die. And of course, that's exactly what happened. And Ahijah here, you know, just shells the corn and lets Jeroboam's wife know, here's why this is going to happen. You know, your husband has betrayed me. He has rebelled against, not just Rehoboam, he's rebelled against God in setting up this false religion. But Jeroboam finished out his life and died. And And then one of his sons took over from that point. And so the kingdom remains divided. The main thing we want to notice here before we move on, I underlined it here, the sin of Jeroboam is mentioned in these passages. Of all the mistakes Jeroboam made in his reign as king of the northern tribes, this alternate religion was the biggie. It was one that had the most severe repercussions throughout the history of these 10 tribes. And we'll talk more about that later on. Okay, so what we're going to do here is just pose some questions for discussion. First, compare God's promise to Jeroboam with his promise to David. How did the two men respond to the promises? There's obviously a contrast here. When God tells David that I'm going to give you the kingdom, what did David do? I'm sorry? Okay. Yeah, his attitude was, okay, God in his own time will make it happen. And even as we've discussed, we were looking at the life of David, when he had opportunity in his hand to kill Saul and end all his problems and take over the kingdom right then and there, what did he do? I will not lift my hand against God's anointed. He still respected Saul as the king, and, you know, God had made a promise, but David was not going to try to jump in and fulfill it for God. This was God's timetable, not his own. How did Jeroboam respond? We read the passage that talked about Jeroboam rebelled against Solomon. I mean, he did lift up his hand against God's anointed. So right there, you've got a sharp contrast between these two men and how they are dealing with the promise of God. But the real connection here I want you to notice is that both men were promised a kingdom by God. I don't know if you've ever noticed that before. But this is one of those very interesting what-if scenarios in the history. And of course, those kind of games are meaningless because it doesn't prove anything. But what if Jeroboam had responded to God's promise the same way David did? What would his kingdom have looked like? Well, I don't know. But it's just the fact that you've got two men given the identical promise, but they responded to it in completely different ways. All right, we're going to look at a couple of passages here. We've looked at 11, 37, and 38 earlier. Let's just glance at that again. This is God's promise. I will take you, and you shall reign over all your heart desires, and you shall be king over Israel. Then it shall be, now notice this carefully, if you heed all that I command you, walk in my ways and do what is right in my sight, keep my statutes and commandments as my servant David did, then I will be with you and build for you an enduring house as I built for David, and I'll give Israel to you. So when God gives a promise like that, you can pretty much go to the bank with it, right? All right, now compare that with chapter 12, verses 26 and 27. This is Jeroboam, after he has come to the throne, this is the thought process that's going through Jeroboam's mind. Beginning in verse 26, Jeroboam said in his heart, "Now the kingdom may return to the house of David. If these people go up to offer sacrifices in the house of the Lord at Jerusalem, then the heart of this people will turn back to their Lord, Rehoboam. They will kill me and go back to Rehoboam, king of Judah." The question is, what does this tell us about Jeroboam's faith? God's promise, Jeroboam's fear. Now just tie those two together, and what do you... Yeah, there's no faith here. You know, God's given him a promise, and in Jeroboam's mind, it's just so many words. It doesn't mean anything. Jeroboam sees his duration on the throne of Israel as entirely a function of who? Well, his people and himself. You know, whatever kind of schemes he can dream up to keep himself in power, keep the people in check, you know, that's what he's going to have to do. Because after all, what's God's promise? You know, it's just not that big a deal to him. And that's why we started out earlier talking about this comparison between Jeroboam and David. It's a fascinating study when you really probe and dig into it a little bit to see how both of these men were in very similar situations, received similar promises from God, and yet one of them accepted that promise in faith and lived his life in keeping with that faith, that promise, and the other man did not. Next question. What motivated Jeroboam to modify the religious traditions of his kingdom contrary to God's word? We've really already talked about that. Yeah, his fear, his unbelief. Look in particular, chapter 12 and verse 33. He made offerings on the altar which he had made at Bethel on the 15th day of the 8th month, in the month, notice this, which he had devised in his own heart, and ordained a feast for the children of Israel and offered sacrifices. It was a feast day that he devised in his own heart. So what was the divine foundation for this? There wasn't one. So that's the whole point. He just dreamed this up on his own because he wanted to. And then compare that to chapter 14 and verse 9, and this is where his wife has come to Ahijah, the prophet, and this is the message that Ahijah gives to him through her. You have done more evil than all who were before you, for you have gone and made for yourself other gods and molded images to provoke me to anger, and have cast me behind your back. Now that's a figure of speech. You can't physically throw God behind your back, but what is implied in that illustration? Throwing God behind your back. What do you usually throw behind your back? Something you don't need. The trash, the garbage. Something that is of no value to you at all. You just throw it behind your back. That's what he's saying you're doing to God. He means nothing to you. And if God means nothing to you, then what are you inclined to do with God's instructions? Same thing, yeah. They don't carry any weight. I don't really care about that. And so, if he sees that there's some personal incentive or motivation for him to just go in and arbitrarily change the feast days, for example, and create something from his own heart, that's something that he likes, no big deal. He'll do it. So, would David have done something like that? Why not? Yeah, he was not about to throw God over his back. He clung to God. God was very important to him. In everything that he said and did and thought, God was supreme. Jeroboam, no way. Why did Jeroboam seek the counsel of Ahijah the prophet? I often think, we've already read this story, of course, the son was sick, but okay, why now? Why don't go to God's prophet now to seek counsel? Okay, expand on that a little bit.
God has promised him kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
His son is going to be the continuation of that
kingdom.
Mm-hmm. Again, he's reminded, he's not told of it, but he's reminded of where the power came from.
Okay. But we've already read that his attitude toward God is one of complete indifference, throwing him behind his back. Why now? Is he wanting to go to God? I'm sorry? He needed something. Okay. Have we ever seen that before? Maybe even in our own lives? When do we tend to go to God the most fervently? When we're in trouble. Right? Yeah. You know, the rest of the time, we can treat God with complete indifference, doesn't matter, yeah, whatever. But when we really get in a bad jam and we're pretty desperate, oh, then God, please help me. And that's what's going on here. Jeroboam can get all nice and religious when he needs something from God. But when times are good and everything is fine, and Jeroboam, you know, feels like he's in control, then not so much. God's just pretty much out of the picture. Well, okay, that's a good question, Judd. If you didn't hear Judd's question, why did Jeroboam send his wife? That might be a good one for us to explore here. And remember, I don't know if I emphasized this a while ago, he told his wife to disguise herself and pretend that she was actually somebody else, that she was not Jeroboam's wife. So kind of connect the dots there. What's going on? Okay. Ashamed of himself?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Send her. He didn't want to go because he knew that he was in trouble. So send her and get her in trouble.
Yeah, he's not going to treat a woman that way, right? But Ahijah didn't hold anything back, you know. And that's the thing. You know, we didn't talk about this earlier, but when Ahijah told this kid's mother, when you step your footsteps across the threshold, your son will die. Just think what's going through her mind as she's trudging on her way back home. Now, how would you or I react to that? If the prophet said, as soon as you step foot in your home, your kid's going to die, what would you be inclined to do? Not go home. But she just marched right on in. A lack of faith seems to just run in this family. There's just not much respect for God. They're trying to deceive the prophet. She doesn't really take him at his word. You know, Jeroboam's already demonstrated that he doesn't have respect for God and what's going on here. I mean, the whole thing is just sad that none of the people involved here really seem to have any kind of serious respect for God. Yeah, Andy.
When if I was in his place, I would be easy to view the things that he changed as not a big deal. That, I want people to go all the way to Jerusalem, let's build altars, cults, build on the cross.
Oh, yeah.
There's the priests all the way in Jerusalem, let's appoint some priests, cults. So it's an easier thing. It's still accomplishing the same purpose. There are logical things that we think are okay. And
we're going to be looking at a question here in just a moment that covers that very thought. Yeah, hold that. Very quickly, why did all the latter kings of Israel cling to the sin of Jeroboam? I have a string of passages here that we won't look at. But the rest of the history of the northern kingdom, every king is held to this standard. How did they treat the sin of Jeroboam? And every one of them held to it. Not a one of them gave it up. And what is the sin of Jeroboam? It's this alternate religion that Jeroboam set up. The very thing that Jeroboam designed to maintain his hold on power, every one of the kings that followed him maintained that same thing. And why? For exactly the same reason. To hold their grip on power. Okay, let's very quickly now apply some of the things we've learned here. Are God's promises unconditional? Was God's promise to Jeroboam unconditional? No. He said, if you will follow me and do my commandments as David did, then I will give you this kingdom and all these good things will happen to you. Well, did he keep the conditions? Nope. Was God obligated to still deliver on the promise? Nope, not at all. Okay, does God need our help keeping his promises? Now compare those two questions.
Yes.
So what did David contribute to getting God's promise? And that earned him the kingdom? Okay. Yeah, obviously, I mean, we could get ourselves all tangled up here in defining the words and the language involved, but I think you see the point I'm trying to get across. Let's move on quickly. Are we free to modify God's instructions to suit our personal interests? And Andy, this gets to your point. The answer is obviously no. Mm-hmm. Right. Exactly. Yeah, and this is a thing that is just so, that's just lost on our society today. By far, the prevailing opinion among most people today is, well, as long as our heart is sincere, it doesn't really matter how we worship God or, you know, whether or not what we're doing has any biblical basis or not. We're just free to kind of, you know, do whatever. Well, are we? I mean, if God has revealed in His Word how He wants us to worship Him and given us details, are we free to just, you know, to use expression here, throw it behind our back because it doesn't personally suit us? Well, of course not. You know, the whole question here is, how are we treating God? And Jeroboam's example is just a classic model of how not to do it. Steve? No. Yeah, they just dreamed up a scheme to keep themselves in power. And then finally, seeking God's help only when we're in trouble is rarely sincere and doesn't impress God. And that's what we were discussing about him seeking the advice of Ahijah the prophet when his son was sick. By the way, we've been talking about the prodigal son on Sunday morning. When did the prodigal son go back to his father? When he was in trouble. So is there a contradiction here? This is the key phrase. When we're in trouble, it's rarely sincere. If all we're trying to do is get out of the trouble, we're trying to find an escape hatch, but our heart really isn't connected with the person we're seeking the help from, then that's phony, that's fake. And God can see right through that. In the case of the prodigal son, he surrendered totally to his father. He was trying to rebuild a relationship with his dad, not just get access to more money. And that's the difference between the prodigal son and Jeroboam. Okay, next week, very quickly, we're going to be looking at Ahab. I entitled this one, How Low Can We Go? And we're going to find out next week just how low a king can go. Okay, thank you very much.